Welcome to another episode of North American Deer Talk, where the fusion of facts and opinions become the education and entertainment for all. This is your host, Josh Newton, and we have another great show for you today. Okay, welcome back, folks. Another episode of North American Deer Talk. It is Friday, June 26th, coming up on the end of June here. Kind of excited to get into July. The bucks are really starting to pour it on. Everybody's getting kind of excited about what they're seeing out there. I know we are here. We have a great show for you today. Got a chance to do an interview actually this past winter, and I'm just getting around to getting it produced and edited up. So we'll go ahead and take care of our sponsors. Just remember, they help make North American Deer Talk possible. The sponsor of our show today is NewDart. For the last 48 years, NewDart has been offering its customers the best remote injection equipment for their needs. The NewDart system is available in a variety of configurations, and it allows for effective and reliable medication or capture work to be performed. Their mission's simple, and it's really a philosophy of giving the customer what they want and what works. Only through extensive feedback from you, its customers, has NewDart been able to achieve this mission. From day one, this 100% American-made product has provided a unique tool for the cervid industry to use. NewDart, because you can't afford to miss. NewDart has been a really integral part of our management techniques and programs here. If you'd like to get some more information, you can check out the link in the show notes. It's just www.newdart.com. They're a tremendous company, and they're working hard to continue to innovate and supply you with the products you need. So that's our main sponsor for today's show. Also want to remind you that if you appreciate the work that we do here, make sure you head over to the membership page of the Cervid Solutions site. Sign up to be a member of our program. We'd really appreciate it. We're trying to build a good community of people there that are all kind of like-minded in their management techniques for animal husbandry. And it's a great way to help support the show. We certainly appreciate it. So again, head over there. There's some great discount initiatives that we set up for you. We're working on some premium content as far as videos and stuff through our Cervid Health Division. So anyway, check that out. We'll go ahead and we'll get into our show today, our main topic. And like I said, we have a great interview that I did this winter with a gentleman from Iowa that many of you know. We cover all sorts of different topics. It's a really, really interesting interview. I think you'll really appreciate it. We cover fleece genetics. We cover the Teague Ranch, animal husbandry, some of the background on one of the grandfathers of our industry. We talk about what some of the tips and tricks are for semen and AI, and we talk sex semen. We talk about the five big lines up here in the north, breeding philosophy, and standards of the whitetail. So I think you'll really enjoy it. And with that, we'll welcome to the show Scott Kent. How are you doing, Scott?
Good.
So we'll get into kind of who you are, where you're from, how long you've been raising deer, all that stuff.
I started raising deer in 2000. I got a phone call one night that Tom Teague was looking for a deer manager, and I met him a couple days later, and that's kind of how I got a crash course in the deer industry.
That's a good place to start.
Yeah. My first job with him was looking after about 150 does. There was no vaccination program, and I learned the hard way.
Yeah. Well, that's, 150 does on a vaccination program is right. A lot of does, but that's a pile of work.
And then in 2000, there was very little known about vaccinations and diseases in deer, so it was learned the hard way, and there wasn't any manuals or any veterinarians that knew much about it at the time, so...
Just trial and error.
That's what I had to do.
Right. So, I guess the school of hard knocks will teach you real quick.
Yeah.
So, Obviously, that was a good learning experience. I mean, once you go through, like, a year of fawning, I mean, we typically see animals with issues or any kind of pathogen, you know, increases in the fawns because their immune systems are not developed. But how'd you go about handling that, and then what did you do to fix those problems?
I've always joked that I've learned a lot about medical things in deer because I've killed a lot of deer. And my first fawning season down there, where I was carrying so many dead fawns out, I knew that the bacteria issues were so important, you know, controlling that bacteria level and finding the right vaccines to control that. And I had to use my background with the cattle industry and stuff, where I was raised on a cattle farm, and kind of coordinate that with my deer program, and eventually got on a program that was working, where I was keeping the deer alive and being able to wean them at decent weights.
So before you went to work for Tom, you were doing cattle work?
I was actually raised on a cattle farm, so
Okay.
That was my background.
So you're doing that all your life?
Yeah.
And that's interesting. So did you, I mean, is there a lot of correlation between raising cattle and deer?
I think just the basic animal husbandry, the disease issues are some similarities, but a lot of differences too. Just being a good general manager of the animals is what I've learned more than anything, and with any animal.
So management practices.
Very important.
So give us a couple examples.
A lot of guys want to show off their deer and they show you pictures. I don't look just at the deer. I'm looking at the pen. I'm looking at the background. You know, is there grass in that pen? Is there weeds in that pen? Is the manure, is it pellets, is it solid, is it liquid? You know, I look at so many factors, and if you're not looking at the whole picture and just the animal, you're not going to see everything.
It's tough. You get antler tunnel vision.
You do.
And I get it all the time because I'm like, oh, man, look at that buck. He's awesome looking. And then you kind of have to remind yourself to take a breath, take a step back. Yeah. Let's look at the whole picture. And because you may have one great buck.
Yeah.
There may be 30 other bucks there that are, they're just no good because they're not maybe in those right conditions. So you got your break in at Tom's place. How long did you work there?
I was at Tom's for about 3 years.
Okay.
And then after that, I left and actually went to work as a large animal vet assistant.
Oh, cool.
So I spent three years as a vet assistant, and that's where I really got in depth on the vaccines and the disease issues and working with the animals. And
so that was also really good. Hands-on experience. Plus, you were probably, I mean, you were working with other animals outside of the deer world. So, you know, you see some of those correlations, but it also gives you a different frame of mind or aspect or perspective is the right word when you look at the deer and say, you know what, I had that cow and had that issue or whatever, and this is kind of like that. You know,
it's amazing how many things you can cross over when you really think about it. And the one thing nice about the guy that I worked for that was a veterinarian there was he wasn't afraid to try things. And with the deer industry, and back then having so many things that weren't labeled for deer and still not labeled for deer,
sure,
you had to be willing to try some things.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're still kind of tweaking different things to find out what works and what doesn't work.
All the time. Yeah. So today's a different story. You're obviously not working at Tom's, and you're not working in the large animal vet field. What do you do today?
In 2006, I got a phone call from Gene that he was going to be coming to Iowa and looking to partner up with the deer business.
Gene Fleece.
Gene Fleece.
Yep.
Or Eugene Fleece, some people call him.
Yep.
I've always called him Gene. And since then, we've heard there in Iowa that's what I do full-time now is take care of the animals. We got about 190 head at the breeding farm, and then we have a 330-acre hunting ranch that's
cool.
All stocked there, too.
And just to give a little background on Gene, I mean, I guess you could say he'd be the father of modern-day deer farming.
Yeah, he's like the grandfather of deer farming.
The grandfather, however you'd want to look at it, depending on your age.
Yeah.
But he, and honestly, I mean, Wilderness Whitetails was my intro into into deer farming. I mean, I remember asking my uncle, like, I went to his place, it was 1999, I was 17 years old, and I was just out of high school, I was got that bug for bow hunting, and I went over there and I said, I was looking at some of his bucks, he had some like 150s, and I was like, oh, this is great, you know? I said, what do I got to do to get in this? He goes, just go to wildernesswhitetails.com, and, you know, this was probably a year or two later, and I'm looking at these bucks, and of course, you know, Buddy's two, and Poncho's there, and Bart's there, and Bucky's still a young guy, and Heavy's three, and I'm just like, that's unbelievable. And so that was my intro, and of course, the hooks were in immediately after I figured out that you could raise those deer like that. And your experience has been a lot different because you have much more personal connection with Gene.
And the funny thing is actually how I got to meet Gene prior to that was Tom Teague had bought several breeder bucks from Gene.
Hmm.
So Gene and I talked several times and always jokingly, you know, said, oh, if you ever want to partner up, let me know. Never thought it would go anywhere.
Right.
And the funny thing was, is, you know, seeing all the big bucks he had in Wisconsin and I always thought, oh, there's got to be something in that feed, you know, he's doing his
sure.
stuff. And now learning, once again, the details and the management, it's all the little things that he did that got him to raise those big bucks.
And Eugene is a stickler for notes.
Very stickler.
If anybody has had a chance to sit down with him for any amount of time, he's got those notebooks. And they're, I mean... There's notes in there.
He currently, even to this day, has a pegboard beside his recliner, and each deer has its own tag,
mm-hmm.
and he's thinking of the breeding program 2 years in advance,
mm-hmm.
and every night he's moving deer around looking to see what the best crosses are going to be, and he's got crosses in his mind for deer that the semen hasn't even been born yet.
Right.
The buck hasn't been born yet to produce the semen, but he's thinking that far in advance to stay up on the genetics.
That's awesome.
And he's just such a stickler on the details and, you know, whether it's the feed or the medical part of it. And him and I have been a neat cross because he brings the genetics part out of the background and I bring the medical part of the background. And, you know, it just correlates so good together.
Yeah. And just for reference, Gene's had deer since 1977.
Correct.
That's long. I mean, that's longer than I've been alive.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Showing my age here a little bit, but whatever. Now you had said that Tom Teague had purchased some bucks from Eugene, and that's kind of how you met. What bucks did he purchase?
Tom purchased Little Boomer, Pretty Boy, and Buster. And I remember when I started working there, he purchased Little Boomer for $100,000, and that was back in 2000. He'd actually purchased them, I think, in 98 or 99. And then Pretty Boy and Buster together was another $100,000. And so, I mean, I was really worried about starting at a place that I knew very little about deer, and I had $200,000 wrapped up in three animals. And at that price, at that time, that was unheard of.
It is. You know? And, that was... If we look at pedigrees today, especially the fleeces pedigrees, Little Boomer, Pretty Boy, especially those two crossed onto each other.
Yeah,
that's the foundation of the herd.
Yeah,
Buster was in there some, not exposed as much.
Buster probably never got the credit he truly deserved.
No, but he was for his day, his mainframe.
Yeah,
I mean, pretty unbelievable.
Yeah,
I mean, I still remember that picture of him and Bucky when Bucky was, I think, two.
Yeah.
Licking each other in the fence.
Yeah.
You've seen that?
I still have that picture.
Yeah, yeah. It's awesome to look. I'm like, oh man, look at that deer.
Well, then the other neat aspect was Tom had just sold 30-30.
Mm.
And he purchased 30-30 for $50,000 and sold them for $150,000 and had the offspring out of them that he got to keep. So I was able to use Gene's genetics through Little Boomer, Pretty Boy, and Buster and cross it on the 30-30 does.
So, and 30-30 is probably one of the most photographed and popularized deer out into the hunting world. I mean, I've seen him on many deer
magazines.
Supplement bags, you know, mineral licks, you name it. Tons of magazine covers. And if people saw him, they know exactly who he is. He himself was a good producer, But his sons and daughters were far beyond him. Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
I mean, he wouldn't stand a chance in today's market, right, as far as his direct production. But boy, his second generation offspring were really good.
His second and even third generations, right, to me, even blew up beyond that. When Tom bred 3030, he produced about 6 or 7 bucks that year. He only bred with him 1 year.
Oh.
And he just simply named him 3030 number one, 3030 number two, 3030 number three. When I started in 2000 down there, 3030 number one and 3030 number two were still in the breeding program.
Okay.
He had a few of the others left, but they weren't in the breeding program. From that, 3030 number one produced several sons that we end up, and to this day, I still have some of the genetics in my herd.
I noticed some of the, you know, on the doe sides, you see some 3030 number one or 63H2, yeah. And it's just, it's neat to see how those have influenced that. Of course, you throw some shots, a little Boomer and Pretty Boy in there. So those, I mean, those, you're talking about genetics from 15 years ago, but you're still seeing the influence of those today.
One of my best does is coming out of that J101 line, which is a 3030 number one son.
Gotcha.
J101 and 63H2 were full brothers just a year apart. They had the same mother, same father.
Gotcha.
And totally different looks, but had that big frame. And then 3030 offspring almost always threw extras off their G2s. You know, I could always look at a pin down there and tell you exactly who the 3030 bucks were just from the extras off those G2s.
And Tom was primarily raising bucks for his ranch there, correct?
Yeah, he still has a 3,200 acre high fenced preserve.
Oh wow!
And even right now is strictly for his own use and his business.
So in the classic sense, he's managing a private herd,
correct,
in a high fenced ranch.
And it's amazing to this day. He has tremendous bucks that nobody's even heard of.
Stuff that people would want to breed with today.
Yeah.
Semen wise.
Yeah, he's got bucks he's turning out to shoot that would be breeder bucks in any other place.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. So, and just to touch on the point, I had mentioned that, you know, I was talking about 15 years ago, you're seeing those 30 number one genetics. And I think that plays to a larger point that our industry today is so, I got to have it now, and there's no patience and no time that's involved in letting these animals really kind of showcase what they can do. And can you speak to that a little bit?
I think we've talked about this a lot in our industry is for 10 years, from 2000 to 2010, this industry did nothing but push for inches. And we kind of got away from what the deer really looked like. And a lot of us are going back to those old genetics now to clean the deer up and you know, get them to back where they used to look more like deer. And I also see that, like with us, you know, I know the 30-30 line. I know the Little Boomer line. I know how to make those crosses. So I don't go out and look for some of the other deer that are popular in the industry because I'm not that they're bad deer. I'm just not familiar with how they should be bred. So I stick to what I know, which is those lines. And then when I get those does, you know, such as Q96, that's one of my best does. She always produces, and I know what I can breed her to her to get those bucks produced.
Does she go back into that?
Yeah.
30-30 number one line? So it's been you're probably as critical on your deer as anybody, maybe next to Gene. I mean, he's probably the hardest on any of those animals there. Like, hey, that doe, she's not going to get it done. She's got the 5x5 frame. We're looking for the 6x6s. You know, we got to breed her to this, you know, whatever. We got to breed her to white oak. He's a 7x7 to work, whatever. So, I mean, in today's world, so you have your older does or you have these older line does. And they still have a classic, we'll call it a classic whitetail look. And if anybody needs to check out what a classic whitetail look is, I'll post a picture of one of Scott's bucks in the show notes, and you can check it out, and you'll understand what I'm talking about right away. it would be it would just be like a larger version of whatever you would see out in the wild, basically. And those are the kind of deer I think that you guys are trying to raise, right?
Yeah. In 2006, when Gene and I started their farm there in Iowa, you know, our goal was to have a 24-inch inside spread as a minimum on our deer. Since then, we've actually increased that to 30-inch minimums. And we're looking at our 2015 offspring now that some of them are going to have 7 to 8 different pedigree or different bucks in their pedigree with a 30-inch spread or larger. So we continually stack those similar traits in the spread to make it more predictable in what we're going to produce.
Do you think that's the most important trait that you guys have bred for or that you focused on anyway?
I think we focus on the spread so much because it's one of the hardest to continually reproduce. You know, the mass and the tine length are going to be a lot easier to consistently reproduce, but that spread, if you don't continually stack the genetics in your favor, you're going to lose out on it.
So you think that you can lose your spread in one generation easily? Easier than, let's say, a mass or a
tine. Correct. Easier than the other traits, I think you're going to lose that quicker than the others.
Okay. So some of these animals that are 7 and 8 times 30 inches on the inside, have you used some of those older lines and then built on them from there?
Yeah, I mean, we're consistently looking for genetics that are going to be compatible to those traits, and we'll have fawns this year that'll have Too Wide and Out of Bounds and Bucky and J101, the old 30-30 line, all stacked together with the same similar looks and width and still keeping that clean look as we can.
And I mean, for the most part, they all have a classic whitetail look. I mean, if you look at them, you'd say, yeah, they're pretty looking deer. You know, it's tough to fault them on certain things.
You know, and this was one of the first years where we actually sold a lot of our shooter bucks. And, you know, when your main frames are averaging over 200 to 210 main frame, you know, that's what the hunters are looking for. And in our preserve, we've always got a little saying that we want the hunter grabbing for the gun and not the binoculars.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to have to convince him he needs to shoot that deer.
How about it? So, excuse me. So, just for reference, if somebody's trying to put some solid inches on, the best kind of inches they can, you think that those are mainframe inches?
Oh, definitely.
And so our mainframes, we're just talking about beams, spread, tine length, mass. That's it. And, you know, a 200-inch mainframe is a handful. And you can put 50, 60 inches on that and not have it be offensive at all.
I really think a lot of today's market, people have lost sight of what a 200-inch mainframe is. And when you really cut it down and show them, a clean 10-pointer 200-inch deer is a monster.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think a lot of people realize how big of a deer that is. We've gotten so caught up to these high-inch scores that we've lost track of what a true big mainframe deer is.
How do you get away from that?
Going back to what Gene does is just being a very, very stickler on the genetics and not breaking from your plan. And, you know, like I said, he's planning 2 or 3 years in advance and using those similar traits all the time to keep that predictability. You know, I had a guy come up a couple years ago that was doing an article on the farm, and the first question out of his mouth was, do you have any 300-inch bucks on the farm? And I said, gosh, I hope not. Because that's not our plan. That's not in our genetic makeup. You know, if that's what we produce and we did something wrong, because that's not what we're trying to do.
Not yet, anyway.
No.
Maybe.
Someday I'd like to have a 300-inch typical deer.
Yes.
And I think it's going to be achievable. We're close.
It'll take some time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think that day will come.
I learned something years ago from Gene that he said is when he produced Bucky, I mean, that was one of his favorite deer. But yet Gene could pick Bucky apart and tell you right away what his flaws were. And Gene could always find something you could improve on every deer that he produced. Mm-hmm. And that always amazed me and impressed me that, you know, just when you thought you had something that was really nice, he was looking to improve that. And, you know, just that there was you were never done improving your genetics.
It's interesting, too. I think, if my memory serves me right, Bucky was born in 96, 97, something like that. So, you know, our industry has just, especially in the past, let's say, 6 years, it's evolved so much. It's changed so much that, you know, when Bucky was really coming into his, we'll call it his heyday, we were still in the early stages of the growth in our market. And two things. At the time, you couldn't, I mean, I would look at Bucky and say, that deer is perfect. This was whatever, 2002, 2003, 2004. I mean, he was one of the first 300-inch deer, if not the first. You know, him and Heavy that 1 year were just,
right.
It was like, they got 200-300 inches up there? What is that? And, of course, he's 34 inches wide, and he got them big brows, and he's 6x6. You got the drop tines. I mean, whoa, everything's there. And you just, you know, to point two, you're like, I don't want to even say what's wrong with that deer, because I don't think there is. But and now we jump ahead today, where you and I can sit down, we can look at every single deer, including our own, especially our own, and say, this isn't right. We gotta get that beam to sweep out more. We gotta get that G2 up. We gotta get those G5s out to 8 inches so we can get that mainframe score up. And Gene's been doing that for 20 years.
And if you're not...
He's so far behind, or far ahead of what everybody else is doing.
If you're not picking them apart, you're not doing your job to improve yourself.
That's a good point. It is. So, let's talk about your breeding program from this past fall. Obviously, you did some AI work. You do some AI work every year.
Yep, we actually... we've done AI every year, and the last 2 or 3 years, we've started doing more of our own, doing it vaginally.
Okay.
This past year, in 2014, I did all the AI work myself with doing it all vaginal.
With you using your own bucks, other bucks?
We use outside? A lot of our own bucks. We're using some outside bucks. We've been finding out the last few years that when we split a conventional straw, between two does that are conception rate is actually higher vaginally than if we put a whole straw in per doe.
Why?
That's a good question. I've talked to many of the AI technicians. I've talked to Ray Favaro. I've talked to Earl Sovey. I've talked to Gordley. The only consensus that we've really come up with is it's kind of like you can only hold so much water in your mouth and you got to spit it out. The doe can only hold so much semen up against her cervix, and it's going to start leaking out. I know that sounds funny. You know, when a buck breeds naturally, he's putting way more semen in there than she needs, but she's only holding so much up next to that cervix that's going to do the job. And I think by putting more than what she needs, you're given a chance for more of it to flow out, too. So
you think it's a matter of physics?
That's my guess, strictly guess.
Yeah. No, we're talking theory here.
But,
that's fine.
All I can tell you is in the last 3 years, I've got the numbers to show that my conception rate's higher when I split straws. And from an economic standpoint, that's a great asset for me to have. So.
Now, and you're I'm assuming that you guys are packing your straws. They're standard half cc, 50 million or whatever.
Correct.
Do you think it would benefit you to go to a quarter cc with 15 million?
The ironic thing is we got to looking at the numbers of the amount of sperm in the semen, or amount of sperm in the straw, because we're also doing sex semen too.
Okay.
And we've been trying doing that vaginally in the last few years. And I've tried one straw, I've tried 1.5 straws, and I've tried 2 straws when they're packed at 10 million. And
this is... frozen semen.
This is frozen sex semen packed
okay.
at 10 million.
Okay.
And this is the first year we tried it, last, be 2013. And in 2014, the results that I had was any doe that got bred with 1.5 or more had conception rates. One straw of the sex semen at 10 million wasn't enough.
For vaginal.
For vaginal.
Right. You choose, I don't mean to jump off, so you choose not to lap AI because of the handling stress? And
we have done a lot of lap AI. We've even used sex semen lap AI, have good results with it. When you start doing 40, 50 deer a year and have a $12,000 to $15,000 AI bill,
it's economics.
It goes back to economics.
Yep.
You know, if I can do it myself and I can get the results, then it goes down to the economics.
Gotcha. Okay. So back to the sex semen.
Back to the sex semen and the number. When you start looking at the numbers and breaking it down, when you're sexing semen through, like, sexing technologies, they're taking out all the abnormalities and deformalities of the semen. So you've got 10 million good sperm in that straw.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm getting results off of 1.5 to 2 straws, I'm looking at somewhere between 15 and 20 million in that dough that I put in.
And this is that 10 million is a post-thaw number.
Correct.
So, and just to be clear for everyone, what he's saying is there's, after the straw is thawed, they're physically putting in 10 million live sperm. So it's not a post-thaw. Now, you can talk about the motility, which is a different thing.
Now then, you look at the conventional straw, and you're starting out with packing it at 50 million. And if you say of that 50 million, what, 30 to 35 million of that semen is going to be good, viable semen, and you split that, you're down to that 15 to 20 million mark again, vaginally. So, in my opinion, from what little numbers that we've done, that 15 to 20 million sperm in that dough vaginally is a sweet spot.
Okay.
And that's where I'm getting my conception rates at. That's why I think it takes more than one straw of sex semen, and it takes less than a full straw of the conventional.
Gotcha. Have you considered packing your conventional for your own farm, just extending it out more and being in that range, or is it just as easy for
you to... We thought about it, but it's just as easy to run the second dough up. And gotcha. I'm not doing anything fancy when I'm splitting straws, to tell you the truth. I've got a little, it's a goblet cut in half that I've slit down the side of it. I put it on my AI gun. The first dough comes in. I push it till it hits that goblet where it's marked for strictly half a straw. I kick her out. The next dough runs in. I pull the goblet off, put the plunger the rest of the way down, and breed my second dough. Gene and I can breed 20 does an hour easily and never knock a single animal out.
And you're doing that in a shoot?
In a shoot.
Yep.
No knockout drugs. And, you know, I'm saving my vet bill. I'm saving the knockout drugs. I'm saving the stress on the animal. And it's just, it goes down to economics.
What kind of conception rates are you guys hitting with your conventional ballpark last couple of years?
It's varied anywhere from... I mean, to be honest, it's been as low as 60%, and it's been high as 80-85%.
So you're in a 70%
average. Yeah, 70-75.
That's real solid.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of where we are every year. And how about the sex semen?
The sex semen, there again, last year was the first year of it vaginally. When I used more than one straw, I was up in that 80% range.
Really?
Yep. When we did sex semen frozen laparoscopically, we had a tremendous up in the 90%.
Have you used any fresh?
I have not used fresh. We're actually in the process this year. We did another experiment, and we're using Buck Plus in the semen.
Okay.
And we did that vaginally.
What is that?
Buck Plus is a product that is made that you can... you got two options. You can take a straw that's frozen, thawed out, mix it up, put it back in the straw, or put the... I'm not exactly sure how the process is on the frozen part of it, but they mix the stuff together with the straw, the semen, and then you can put that in the dough, and it inhibits the female part of the sperm.
So basically it's a liquid additive to the semen that kind of knocks those female cells out.
Yeah, I mean,
and just allows the males to...
In a layman's term, that's what it is.
Gotcha.
And you can, they've got Buck Plus if you want more bucks, and they got Doe Plus if you want more females. What we did, because I didn't like the idea of having to take the time and thaw the straw out, mix the product up, and put it in the dough, because it has to set with the straw for 20 minutes, is my understanding.
Okay.
So what we worked out this year was we actually collected one of our bucks and mixed the collection with the buck plus, drew the straws out and froze it. And so I can use it right as I thaw it out.
Cool.
I don't know what the results are going to be this year. We did about a dozen does that way just as an experiment to try. And I did some with one straw and some with a half a straw there again to see where my conception needs to be.
Interesting. So, I mean, the semen looked... You looked at it under the scope, obviously, when you thought, and it looked, it wasn't anything different.
Yep.
So we're just, it'll be...
There's a few, three or four farms that I've been in communication with this year that's trying it, so...
So we'll have a little bit of data.
Kind of a learning experience this year to see where we need to be with that.
Cool.
It's, there again, the economics of it, it probably cost me about $500 a collection this year to do that.
Additional onto the collection cost?
Yeah.
Okay.
Versus the... Sexing Technologies has cost me about $5,000 a collection.
Right. Huh. Yeah, that'll be interesting to get that data and just,
We're pretty excited about that because, there again, if we can, in today's markets, if I can breed my own deer with sex semen, it goes back to the economics of what I wanted to produce.
So, just with your model there of the sex semen where you're figuring... 15, 18, 20 million is working good for the vaginal. Have you communicated with Sexing Technologies to say, hey, load me up some of these doses?
We have. I've talked with them several times, and it can be done. It can be packed at that higher rate. It's a little bit of a new thing for them. And I guess I was a little concerned right now with trying to be the guinea pig on that project. To me, I feel we've got bigger issues of trying to get better collections done of just regular packing and not trying to confuse them with too much at once. I think we've got bigger issues as far as, sending samples down there and getting better collections done.
Having some sort of standard that we can all work from where,
yes,
we collect a buck, we're getting... X amount of ejaculate or X amount of cells, their minimum requirement, I think, is 2.1 billion, viable sperm when it gets down there. And we're looking at conventional collections that are, let's just say, in the 100 straw count range.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll end up getting back, 20, 25, 30 male straws. I mean, the females are the same, but...
And I would say that, from our experience... That's a good scenario.
Yeah, or even having those quality collections go get QC'd or go through the machine and then they're no good and they get tossed or something like
that.
And that's tough.
We've had many collections where we sent down there and got nothing back.
Mm.
And so, it's a learning process. It's early in this whole sex semen project, and I mean, we're still learning, is it the shipping part of it, is the handling part of it, is it the cool down part of it. We've got a long ways to go with getting the semen sexed. It's a great aspect, a great tool once we get it all figured out.
I think it's necessary for our industry,
and
we don't have a choice but to evolve towards that kind of way of thinking.
There's no reason to keep producing all these does that we don't need.
Right. I'm not trying to harp on Sexing Technologies, but it's a newer technology for our industry. But they've been processing cattle semen for how many years?
For those of us that started AI in 2000, that was a new technology. We've AI'd a lot of deer with poor conception until we got figured out, what we're doing wrong.
I was 0-for-6 my first year, and I think that was 2002, I think.
Yeah.
We had our first group of deer, and
when you stop and think about it, I've been AI'ing deer for 15 years.
Yeah.
And we've seen
a long way
improvement.
Yeah.
So, we can't expect the Sexing Technologies to figure it all out in a few years, but it'll be neat to see in the next few years, not only getting the collections, improvement, how many we get done collected, but also maybe start bumping the numbers up. They either pack it at 8 or 10 million right now. Well, what if we start packing at 12 or 15 million?
Yeah, kind of dialing that protocol in.
And start doing more vaginal with it and making it more economic.
Yeah.
So I think we started this thread on talking about the breeding program. Let's actually get to the some of the semen that you did use. So what kind of bucks did you use this year?
This year we used a lot of our own deer, just there again because we know that what we can do with them and what we can cross them with. Some of the outside stuff we've used was we used some Witch Doctor this year. We like that width.
Mm-hmm.
I've used a lot of White Oak, Len Koblenz. Len Koblenz's deer, if you really look at their pedigrees and what they've produced in the last 15 years, just big typicals after big typicals. I mean, from White Oak to Slammer, you know, all the way back to Reedway Bend. You know, look how many pedigrees Reedway Bend's in the back of a Texas mm-hmm. T and Stickers and Big Stitch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so just looking for those consistent traits like that.
And just, I know White Oak, for one, well, all of Lynn's deer that I've seen, they all go back basically into that Oscar line.
Yeah.
And what a really unexplored line. And for anybody that doesn't know the Oscar line, it's basically the line that kind of built Dean Bontrager's. That's talking Sundance, we're talking High Roller, we're talking all those deer. But Lynn took it a different way.
Yeah.
It's just, I mean, if you look at what, let's just pick High Roller for one. I mean, look at what that imprint has put on the industry. Now, just take High Roller, but take a cleaner version of them, basically.
And it's funny when you really look, especially for the guys that's been in this industry for, you know, over 15 to 20 years, you can trace about all these pedigrees back to five different either bloodlines or producers, however you want to say it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a big shock to me when you start seeing these northern deer being used on the Texas bloodlines, and you're seeing this explosion. Is, you know, we talk about line breeding, but the northern genetics have been line bred for a long time because they all go back to the five main bloodlines.
But why don't you run those off for guys?
You know, when you look at it, I mean, whether you're talking about the you know, if you want to talk about the producers, you've got the Fleece line, you've got the Dean Bontrager line, you've got the Burkholder line, which, you know, goes back to the Patrick and stuff, the Brad's or Griffith brothers,
P.A. Geronimo
line, and let's see, who is
Wadvogel,
yeah,
yep, yeah, that Max line's just, I mean, you throw that in there, it was always I remember like 6-7 years ago, I was like, I'm gonna, and those were the lines, you know, and that's kind of how everything was built. I was like, I'm just going to get one deer that's got every mm-hmm. one of the lines in there. And that was just a fun thing for me. And I did it, and it ended up being a deer, you know, it was nothing special, but it was fun for me to try to do. But yeah, you're right. We really have been line breeding those deer on a, I would say a loose scale for
right.
20 years.
Right.
I mean, there's a few, there's a few of those kind of outside lines that guys are working with, and they're non-related, and I think people will find value in those lines. But you're right. I mean, those lines, they dominate the day. And you go back, I think today, if you went back probably in that 6 to 10 generation mark in these animals, you find all those names.
Yep.
Over and over and over again.
And it's really funny because you're seeing the big, you know, the big jump with people buying Texas semen now and bringing it up to the north again. And to me, it's like a big circle. You know, a lot of the Texas stuff came from the north, and now we're starting to bring it back up north again.
I was going to say that there was a big push, you know, 5 years ago in Texas to bring all the northern stuff in.
Yep.
Yeah.
And, you know, even in our herd, you know, in the last couple of years, some of the stuff that's really blown up for us is using the northern lines that we knew that produced well. And we're bringing in Two Wide and King George and some of those Witch Doctors, some of the southern lines that we like the looks of that are as much, you know, unrelated as we can get, and crossing them and getting that jump.
And they're, I mean, if you look at it, they're, and I touched on this with another gentleman in another show, they're a different subspecies. Texas is, it's not. Yes, they are whitetails, but people have to understand, when you take a northern animal and you put a Texas deer in it, they're not the same deer. I don't know how to explain it. Regionally, they're different, and there's thousands of years of these animals breeding these.
And they have to be different pools. Because of the climates. I mean, you know, a northern deer is not going to survive in Texas, and a Texas deer is not going to survive in northern when you move them right off the bat.
No, not well.
Not well.
Some may adapt.
And like you said, they are just pretty much a different subspecies of the whitetail. And it's, I think the northern people get a little blindsided because they're looking at these big deer that Texas is producing right now. Then they're beautiful deer, but we lose aspect of the body size of those deer. And when you're used to seeing 200 to 250 pound bucks and a 250 inch frame on those deer, and then you look at a 250 inch buck in Texas that's on a 100 pound body, there's a big difference in the aspects.
Or 130 pound body.
Or 130
yeah,
pound
yeah,
body.
But sure.
If you're in southern Texas, or but it's
that's
it
right.
makes a big difference.
It does.
And in Texas deer, I've heard a lot of the Texas guys say they're a prettier animal and they're beautiful. That short hair, and they're just so slick.
That gray coat is awesome.
They're beautiful.
Yes.
And that they just got that showiness to them. And
we get those beautiful animals, but ours come in September.
Right.
As soon as that summer hair goes away and you see those guys filling in, if I could buy 100 capes, I'd buy September capes.
But
they're just awesome.
But I think we have to, remind ourselves that when you look at these animals and, some of those scores, they may not be as high as they look like, but they're still big animals.
No doubt.
200-inch deer on a Texas body just looks enormous.
It does. Yeah, I started just, for instance, Midnight Ranger. I taped his ears this year. They were over 21 inches tip to tip. That's a big head.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, he's an 8-year-old deer, but that gives you perspective. I put a tape around his neck, basically in front of his shoulders, 35 inches. He's a monster.
Yeah.
You just won't, those, and I don't know the specifics because honestly, I've never measured any of those Texas deer, as far as their head sizes. But, if they had 17 inches tip to tip on their ear, that'd probably be a big head for one of those guys.
I get such a kick out of our Texas hunters will come up and hunt in our preserve. And it's one thing for them to shoot the big antlers, but they get into these big bets on the body size of these deer. Everybody wants to weigh their buck to see what it weighs because they've never seen 200 or 250 pound bodies. And they're so used to grabbing a deer they shoot with, one arm and pulling it out of the ditch. And, some of our deer, they're not wanting to do that.
And I honestly think we have, in that respect, I think we have an advantage over the Texas breeders in the fact, yes, I understand that they can breed with northern deer, and a lot of them have, and they have those in their pedigrees, but we're able to physically carry more antler up here because of our body size. In addition to that, the nutrients from antler growth come out of the skeletal structure of the body. So if you have a smaller deer, it's a lot tougher for them to pull the calcium requirements that come out of the ribs and the shoulder blades up into those antlers.
Well, and one of the things that we're really seeing a lot of in the last few years especially is we've done such a good job with the genetics and the nutrition that we're producing these animals with such enormous racks that they're not strong enough or big enough to keep their head up all day long, and they're starting to lay down, and you're seeing antler infections more than you've ever seen before. And regardless if it's a shooter buck or a breeder buck, if you can't keep the animal alive or healthy enough to get to the breeding season, that's a big problem. And
yeah.
I have so many guys calling me, they're cutting antlers in July because of antler infections and stuff. And it's just, one of the big problems is they're not being able to keep their head up because their necks and bodies aren't strong enough with these big racks.
Yeah. I guess to be fair, not all antler infections are caused by a deer laying its head down or something like that. They might nick some velvet on the fence or, get gouged up at a feeder, whatever.
We all know if it can happen with deer, it's going to happen.
That's right. Living every day to die. I know that's a tough line, but they do. Sometimes they find ways to die. They really do. So, So we're still on the semen thread and what you bred with. We got some two wide, some King George. We threw some white oak in there, and you used some of your own bucks. What are the bucks that you guys used?
We used Big Buddy this year. In fact, you'd like that buck. He comes out of Buddy Ranger, which is a full brother to the Midnight Ranger.
Okay.
We crossed Buddy Ranger on a big guy doe and produced Big Buddy. He was a clean 10-point there with... he was 31 and a half inches inside, just a beautiful, typical deer. We're pretty hopeful what we get out of him. We also used King. It was a three-year-old out of King George. And Q96, one of our good producing does out of the old 30-30 line.
Gotcha. I think I saw one. You have his antlers at the booth?
Yeah.
He's a beast.
Yeah, he was 200,
kind of heavy.
215-inch mainframe, 10-point. And just had a 250 gross. We had a few extras, but big, massive. And the funny thing was we knocked him out to had him on the health paper to go to a hunting ranch. And got to put in the tape measure to him and realized, you feed these deer every day. And you just don't realize how big some of them are until you get them in your hands.
Mm-hmm.
So he got taken off the trailer and put in the breeding program.
Good.
And then we got a couple big yearlings that we're using. Another one out of King George and... one that we call Triple Threat is he's got Two Wide Two, which was a buck that we produced out of Two Wide, and he's real hopeful.
So I got to ask you, I've bred with yearlings in the past, and I find myself having great difficulty doing that today. What are you guys looking for when you're doing that? It's a tough deal.
It really is. I'm very skeptical of buying semen from a yearling.
Yep.
But
you don't have control over it.
It's a risk.
Yeah.
You know, if the deer blows up next year, you look pretty smart buying semen as a yearling. There's so many things that can happen. You know, he could die or he could go downhill next year, and you really look silly buying semen out of that deer as a yearling.
Mm-hmm.
The reason we used the two bucks that we did was, there again, we know the bloodlines, we know what they're capable of, we feel pretty strong that they've got a very good chance of getting bigger than what they are. And in the past, like I said, Gene's been breeding deer for 30 years. His best crosses have came from yearlings, breeding yearlings. And it's...
What's the philosophy behind that?
I was afraid he's going to ask that.
Yeah, because I've talked to other people about this, and there's been some debate.
I can't explain. All I can say is I've seen time and time again deer that were bred for several years, and the stuff that they produced the best was the very first year they were bred with.
So we'll go a little deeper into breeding philosophy. Of course, anything's possible. Do you think it's possible that these animals... I've seen a lot of tremendous bucks come out of fawns. Do you think it's possible that these first matings have some sort of chemical reaction, physical energy that's brought together in these breedings because of their maturity rates? I'm not trying to get like out on this space limb, but like, do you think there's something else there potentially that is contributing to this? Is that possible?
I think, to make it simple, I think there's something there. I don't know exactly what it is, but there's something that as a younger animal, they seem to not only carry and pass the genetics better, but enhance them as well. If that makes any sense. I'm not sure exactly what causes that, but
we're not talking, the DNA doesn't change.
No.
The DNA is the same. Well, here's a good one for you. So, and the reason I kind of asked that first question is, I read a book by a horse breeder, and he's an old school horse breeder, and he's raised probably as many championship thoroughbreds as possible, and he said that, and they were doing AI back in like the 50s with horses or something, so long time ago. Mm-hmm. And he said, you will never raise a championship horse out of AI. He said the only champions ever come from physical mating. And he said he proved it because they have incredible the records for horses are incredible. And he said that there is basically something, and this guy was Italian. This was all translated long after he died, but he said there's something that's transferred in the cosmos that actually they have passive energy that transfers through these breedings, and these offspring get it. And I often thought about that with deer, about what he said, and I kept trying to look at it and say, well, this animal is this, and maybe I was looking at it wrong, but I just wonder if the animal's energy is not so much spent up when they're young.
It's funny because, you know, I've got a degree in wildlife, and mm-hmm. I've studied genetics, and if you look at from the genetics classes you take, it doesn't make sense, you know, that the age would have anything to do with it. But when you actually look at the proof of whether it's deer or horses or dogs, I always look at horses and dogs because they're two of the animal industries that really look at genetics closely.
And they have the data.
And they've got the data, and they've done it for years.
Yeah.
And, you know, like you're saying, the horse industry and the thoroughbreds have showed time and time again of these young stallions that are producing more better than the older ones, and or even in the same stallion, what he produced later on in life,
right.
It wasn't comparable to what he produced in that first year or two.
Right.
And you know, I see it in the deer, and it's one thing to research it and try it, but when you see proof of it over and over, you know, that's what really makes you look at it really strong.
Yeah, and just to put that into perspective, there are pedigree charts in thoroughbred horses that go back over 300 years. I've mm-hmm. seen them. In addition to that, they have really detailed records on all the winners of the Epsom Derby and Kentucky Derby, you know, for us American folk here. When and if do you think the deer industry will ever adopt some sort of standardized record-keeping system? Do you think that'll be something that we need or is going to happen? Or
I think the deer industry has a lot of standardizations they need to come up with.
Because we don't have any.
No.
We have a DNA number.
Yeah.
We have an age. We got a tag number. About it.
We're still coattailing a lot of the other industries on... You know, we use the standards of cattle semen processing as our gold standards for deer semen, you know, which I don't agree with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's similarities there, but they're not the same animal, and the semen's different in the way it's collected and processed and what we consider is passable. You know, there's a lot of standards out there that I think the deer industry could benefit from. And, you know, these are several.
Is it going to take a push from the producers in that industry? Is it something that, you know, some of our organizations need to work for or set up? Or, I mean,
I think it's going to have to be the producers. I don't think anybody else is going to do it for us. And, you know, nobody wants to stick their neck out on the line to say these are the standards. And if you really think about the deer industry, I mean, we're still a relatively new industry.
Yes.
You know, we're in the baby stages if you compare to the 300 years of horse breeding.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, the deer breeding, you know, we're still in the last 10 to 12 years of AI work and stuff. You know, some of it, you know, 15 is probably for some of us as long as anybody's been doing it.
Yeah.
So, you know. Yeah, we need a lot of standards, and I think, to me, the semen, what we pass our semen quality is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that kind of goes what we were talking about earlier with the sexing semen.
Right.
You know, I think we're still probably comparing those numbers to cattle, and I see a lot of semen that doesn't look good that breeds deer.
Yeah, it's a starting point.
Yeah.
But it needs further development.
I need it tweaked a little bit.
Yeah. Hmm. Okay, so we got the breedings done. We got some semen work done. You guys ever look into doing any kind of embryo work at all?
I don't think so.
Not today, anyway.
No. there's a lot there again. There's a lot to be learned on embryos. I think it probably has its place. I just, to me, in order to want to do embryo work, it would take a very special doe, and it's hard for me to justify at these stages of the embryo world is taking my best doe and taking such a risk on her. And for may or may not get an embryo collection, and she may or may not breed back. And, you know, when I can AI her and get some out of her that year.
But it's, it's possible.
Yeah, I'm not ruling it out. To me, it's just a little bit earlier in our stage of in our management to do right now. Mm. If I get a buck that I don't have a big collection off of or don't have much semen out of, and I want to take and breed her to my best, or breed him to my best doe, and you know, preserve that line, then yeah, that might be something I look at is doing embryos. Hmm. But I think embryos have their place. But on the other hand, you know, what's the value of an animal if you're going to have four or five of the exact same things or very similar ones?
I often wondered. So, what if you had this special doe, and you said, you know, I'm gonna breed her to whatever buck, because I think that's going to make her better. And, you know, I'm going to flush her and I'm going to get, hopefully, whatever, 8, 10, 12, 15 embryos. And I'm going to use all those. I'm going to take all those offspring that year. I mean, you could potentially flush a doe twice in a year. I know it's not recommended, or at least we don't know if it is or not, but I'm sure you could. And you do that with another buck that you think would enhance other certain things. And then you start crossing all those together. Mm-hmm. I mean, and you just literally would blanket your herd trying to create one dominant animal. I mean, because that's what you're doing, aren't you? Isn't, like, oh, and I put it this way to somebody earlier, and let me see if I can make this make sense. So you have the ability for, I mean, a buck will, or a doe will live, let's just say a good doe will live 10 or 15 years, and she'll give you two fawns a year. So in her lifetime, max, she's given you, you know, 28 animals. That's a lot of fawns. Mm-hmm. A buck in 1 year through a semen collection can give you hundreds, and we're able to judge those bucks so much quicker. Mm-hmm. And it takes so much longer to judge those does. When you get those special does, why wouldn't you want to have 100 offspring? Just think about being able to get 100 offspring from a doe.
The one thing I keep going back to and thinking, when, and I know exactly what you're talking about, is there has been deer that were cloned. And they've produced bucks. Mm-hmm. And even though the bucks were cloned, they were still different. Now, they may have had similarities, they may have all been big, but they're all different. And they don't all, even though they're cloned, they don't look, their antlers don't even look exactly alike.
Right.
So, you know, when you're trying to reproduce an animal that you like, I mean, that's why you're breeding for an animal, what you like, a certain look or whatever, mm-hmm. you can breed her 1,000 different times. And you may never reproduce that exact look. Now, you may get similarities. So even the embryo work and stuff, you're not going to reproduce that exact animal again.
No.
But you're looking for the qualities that you want to enhance and keep those, you know, those qualities and those genetics moving forward.
If you keep seeing that 80% of her sons are over 30 inches, you'd say, I think maybe that's a wide doe.
Yeah.
Maybe you breed her to the, you know, the widest long time buck because she has shorter tines, or however that works. Yeah.
And I think it also goes back to looking at some of these places that breed 200-300 deer a year. They're going to produce a lot of big bucks when you're breeding that many deer a year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you look at a lot of the, especially some of the northern guys that are, you know, their average herd size may be 10, 15, 20 does. You know, they're not going to produce as many big bucks because of the numbers.
No, but I would say on a percentage basis, a lot of the smaller farms are kicking the snot out of the bigger ones.
I agree.
Yeah.
In my personal opinion, you could give me any buck, and if you breed him to 200 does, you're going to produce something out of him.
Especially with the quality of does we have today.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah, and people, they do need to realize that. And that's not to knock any of the big farms at all. It's just to, it's put things in perspective.
Yeah, and you know, it goes back to the management. there's a big difference between taking your does, looking at their backgrounds, finding out what's going to cross well, what their weaknesses are, what you need to improve on, and then taking 10 does and just putting 10 straws of semen in them and saying, oh, I hope this works.
To that point, do you think that, I mean, we've seen a tremendous increase in the number of newer people coming into the industry, and you talk a lot about, when we started the conversation with health management and how important those husbandry practices are. Do you think that you'll see farms separate themselves from the industry as far as their animals because of their management practices? And I can say that a different way. Do you think that some of these newer farmers, because they don't have the experience with the animals, are going to have problems in the growing process or the production process?
I think you're already starting to see some of that. I mean, if you look at these auctions, and I've been going to these auctions for 15 years, and it's a different crowd. There's only a handful of us that have been to these auctions every year for that many years. Mm-hmm. And it's sad to go to these auctions and see new people get caught up in these high prices and buy into it and not be able to get their money back because they can't produce the big animals, or if they do, that bloodline is, went by the wayside by the time they produce something out of it, and they didn't get the value that they paid into it. I think those days are over with. I think people have caught on to that, buying on hype is not going to get you anywhere, and you're seeing people look more into the guys that are consistently producing the deer year after year after year and the quality behind them. And I think we're starting to see that change.
Is there something specific that, like when you guys sell a doe, for instance, do you just give them a pedigree and send them on their way? Is there something that you guys do that kind of says, do you have health records? I mean, how do you do yours?
We have a joke statement that we tell people is, when you buy a deer from us, when the trailer door's shut, the deal's not over. We're not going to say, here's your deer, kick you on your way, and good riddance. If you're not going to make money off a doe you bought from us, then we're not going to make money. Because the best way to advertise is word of mouth. And if my customers that bought deer from me aren't bragging about what they got and what they're producing with it, then I'm not going to have business down the road. Mm-hmm. And I make sure that when people buy deer from me, first of all, I want to know that they know how to take care of those animals, because I'm concerned about the animals and I want them to do well. And we make sure we look at their feed, we look at their pens, if they need help with handling facilities set up, we look at the whole package, their vaccine program. I want them to do well. I want them to grow bucks as bigger than I am, because I want people to know where they came from.
And additionally, you have the opportunity to, if they do grow a big buck, say, I want to buy some semen from that guy, because those are genetics from here that walk right back into what we're doing. Yeah, and that's awesome.
And you can see that in the guys that are, at these auctions year after year after year, they're not going out of business because they're taking care of their customers. They're producing a product that's keeping them alive. And, and one of Gene's, sayings is, do something that you can compare in price and beat them in quality. And that's what we've always tried to do.
Hmm. Say that again.
Put out a product that compares in price but beats them in quality.
Mm-hmm. And the quality product wins every time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, it's just, I guess what you're also saying, that, that quality product is not just the deer. It's everything else that goes with it.
It's the whole package. And I don't want to buy, I don't want you to come buy a deer for me. I want you to come buy a deer for me and maybe come back and buy a breeder buck from me, or come back and buy semen from me, and it's not just a one-time deal. And if that deer dies and it was a flip deal, I'm going to replace it. I'm going to take care of you. Because that is going to get out. And the old saying is, if you treat somebody bad, they're going to go tell 10 people. If you treat them good, they're going to tell one person.
Right.
And, that word of mouth advertising, you can't buy.
No. No, there's no price or value you can put on it. And it's,
I mean, almost all the good businesses today, if you look at them, I mean, that's how they grew. It was organic growth. It's not paid for.
Yeah. And if you look at any business, if you go buy something and you're not happy with it, you can bring it back. And I don't want my customers not happy with a product. You know, if they're not happy, I'm going to make it right.
Right. Nice. Well, we've been chatting here over an hour. So in closing, again, and I know you have a unique relationship because you've been able to work with Gene. I mean, can you just touch on a few more of those things about what it's like working with him, and maybe some of the stuff he does, and just
one of the funny stories I always tell people is, like I said before, I always thought Gene had this magic ingredient that he put in the feed to grow these big bucks, and when we started working together, you know, he's very detail oriented on every little aspect, from the nutrition to the genetics, you know, always studying everything. And one of the times he brought out this dustpan, and I asked him what the dustpan was for. And every time we feed every morning, every night, every day, and when you put the feed in the trough, he always makes sure that there's enough room for all the animals to eat at one time.
Okay.
Because the deer will come up, especially bucks, and if you have your pipe feeders or whatever, one or two will go up and eat, and when they leave, the rest of the deer will go with them. So a lot of the deer don't really get to eat as much as they would because they're such a herd animal that they want to stick together. So he always makes sure he has enough trough space for all the animals to eat at one time. So when we feed the next time, we take our dustpan, and if there's any fines in the feed, which your fines are going to hold your vitamins, your minerals, you know, all the important stuff for the antler growth,
mm-hmm.
he takes that and sprinkles it back on top because the deer, that's the only way they're going to be able to pick it up.
Sure.
And that little $2 dustpan probably makes us more money than anything else on the farm.
That's awesome.
And it's just that's just one of the little details, you know, that I always thought how amazing that little dustpan probably makes us more money than anything.
Now, if everybody heard that, you go out, you get yourself the dustpan, you're going to make some money.
That's great.
No, and that's it's really neat, and only I've never heard somebody say, make sure you have space for all the deer to eat at once, because they'll walk. I've never heard somebody say that. But Gene learned that through experience.
Yeah.
He watched it happen and he made a solution to that problem. And
as the bucks, it's funny because you can say you have 20 bucks in a pen or 10 bucks in a pen and you have enough space for them to eat. Well, throughout the summer when their antlers are growing, it takes even more space than that because the antlers are growing and mm-hmm. taking up more room. So, we, you know, midsummer, we're adding more feeders so they can spread out more and not damage themselves hitting the antlers.
You guys are going to have bucks from one side of the pen to the next if you keep breeding with those 30 inchers.
It's pretty big.
Well, we'll wrap up on that good note, and we certainly appreciate you taking the time to talk with us, and hopefully get a chance to do it again.
Well, thank you.
Hey, thanks.
Well, there it is. What a great interview. I'm really glad I got a chance to sit down with Scott. You know, in addition to being a deer farmer, Scott serves, I believe he's the first vice president on the NDFA board. And, you know, NDFA does a lot of good work for us. Scott's definitely a leading voice in our industry, and, you know, I commend him on the work that he does. So thanks again, Scott. We appreciate it here. And as always, folks, you know, if you want to help support the show, head over to the CSM or the Servant Solutions membership, and we'd love to have you as part of our community we're building here. With that, we'll wrap up, and as always, stay tuned for another episode of North American Deer Talk.